Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. The era of great power politics appears to be upon us again. The Pentagon is again called the War Department, and the Trump administration apparently plans to focus more on domestic and Western Hemisphere issues instead of Russia and China. Will it be a Fortress America against the world? Crosstalking great power politics, I'm joined by my guest, Christian Parenti in New York. He is a professor in the Department of Economics at John Jay College, City University of New York. In Salt Lake City, we have David Pine. He is Deputy Director of National Operations for the Task Force on National and Homeland Security. And in Beijing, we have Einar Tanjin. He is Senior Fellow at the Taihei Institute, as well as Chairman of Asia Narratives. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Basically, I want to talk about the upcoming national defense security strategy coming out of the Trump administration. But as a preamble to that, I'd like to go to Einar in Beijing. Donald Trump, in one of his Truth Socials, wrote, "Looks like we've lost India and Russia to deepest, darkest China. May they have a long and prosperous future together." What does that tell you? I mean, that can mean a lot of things to a lot of people. What is it, your point of view, when Donald Trump talks about China that way?
Well, Peter, there was another part to that where he was admiring the parade. I think he was thinking about the rather poor effort that was made on his behalf in terms of his birthday. But that also goes to this envy issue. He wants to be, you know, just like the boy from Queens. He wanted to be a cool guy in central New York. Manhattan, but it, you know, they never accepted him. And now he's going through that once again, psychologically. In terms of how he sees the world, I don't think it's useful to say that he has policies. He has different approaches that he throws A. If A doesn't work, he does B. This is what you do in real estate. So his first part was, oh, I'm going to make a deal with China. I'm going to split Russia and China. And then it was on to this idea that, okay, I'm going to craft my idea of a modern-day Yalta, where we split up the, you know, the universe, and I come out and put my face on Mount Rushmore after I've collected my Nobel Peace Prize.
Well, I mean, I'm going to go to Christian here. What's coming out about this national defense strategy is quite interesting, is because if you compare it to his first administration, China was designated as an adversary, if not even an enemy. And now he wants to focus on the Western Hemisphere and, remarkably, on the United States itself when it comes to the military. We could talk about the constitutional issues of that, but I'd like to just focus on the Western Hemisphere. Is that a preamble to the what I would call the Venezuelan model?
What I think is going on here is that Trump, who I've described as sort of the idiot savant of American politics, you know, he's like a jazz musician who can't read music, but he knows what notes the audience likes. He knows what notes to play politically. And he's responding to some very profound structural problems, at the heart of which is the 40-year process of really 50 or 60-year process of deindustrialization of the American economy and the concomitant financialization of our economy and the rising inequality of all of that. And this has left the U.S. in a position where it no longer has the capacity to project power, both hard and soft, in a way that it used to. And so Trump is now dismantling much of the infrastructure of this old post-war hegemonic system that the U.S. presided over. And he's selling it to his base by basically outer borough, as the other guests were saying, kind of, you know, hey, we don't even, you know, the rest of the world isn't even good enough to be bullied by us anymore. So there's a kind of an instinctual theater to what amounts to a necessary, almost inevitable structural retreat from a kind of global hegemony that the U.S. had. China makes half the world's ships. China has a monopoly on rare earth elements. The heavier of these metals, these are needed for their conductivity and their magnetic properties, are used in everything from medical equipment to weaponry. China has a stranglehold on these materials, and the U.S. needs them badly, and China has imposed export bans. This isn't getting a lot of attention in the U.S. press, but this is very, very important. This is why the tariff ceasefire with China has been extended three times now. So the United States, of its own accord, of its own making, is in a much weakened position. And Donald Trump represents a kind of coming to terms with this, mixed with a sort of theatrical denial. And so in that, he's pulling back to a sort of neo-Monroe doctrine, Western Hemisphere. That's what the, you know, we want Greenland is all about. It's about, like, shoring up. And it is, that is fundamentally, love it or hate it, I mean, I think that's realistic. That's what has to happen. If to say, oh, we're going to, you know, we're going to go out, we're going to tell China what to do. That's simply, like, whether you would like that or dislike it is almost irrelevant. That's impossible for the U.S. now.
Well, David, so, I mean, what we're getting back to is a great power politics, the title of this program, and what's traditionally called spheres of influence. Now, I'm going to let you gentlemen decide if that's good or bad, but I would say that has been the history of geopolitics, spheres of influence. Now, the post-war World War II order said, no, we don't have spheres of influence anymore, which meant the entire world was America's sphere of influence. Now, Donald Trump appears to be stepping back and saying, I like this neo-Monroe doctrine. I think that's well put here. I mean, is that America first? Is that good for America? Is it good for the world? David.
It's absolutely good for the world. The spheres of influence concept, it worked pretty well during the pre-World War I era. It worked exceptionally well after Yalta. I view that as kind of a shameful surrender of Eastern Europe. But the fact is that it brought a lasting great power and nuclear peace. It averted World War III. It was honored by both sides until 1999, really, is when NATO was expanded foolishly to Russia's borders in Eastern Europe. But that is a concept I've been championing since at least 2021 in articles in the National Interest magazine. And essentially, what I've been advocating is something that I've heard that Russia is amenable to as well, which is that the U.S. would have a sphere of influence, of course, over the Western Hemisphere and NATO member states. And then we would accord recognize a Russian sphere of influence over the entire former Soviet Union, minus the Baltic states, including Ukraine. And so that wouldn't give each side carte blanche to invade countries within our sphere of influence. But primarily, it would be essentially a pledge of non-interference in each other's spheres of influence. So we should not be able, we as in the West, should not be able to interfere in Ukraine. And that, of course, would have averted the war in Ukraine entirely had that been adhered to.
Well, Einar, I mean, a cynic would say, and I'm a cynic, this is national defense strategy. It's all nice and fine. We'll see what the final print is. But you could also claim that this is just American empire reallocating resources, okay? I mean, you can come out with a grand statement. The liberal order, it sounds good to everybody, but it wasn't good for everyone, particularly the American middle class for the last 60, 70, 80 years. Go ahead in Beijing.
All right. So I just want to add something to my first colleague, and that is, you know, the reason America lost out on manufacturing was deliberate. We decided that we would rather have a strong dollar rather than strong exports, and that affected us. So this idea that it was somehow just happened and that, gee whiz, you know, what happened? Well, America is not a victim. America has been the victim. Across the board. Now, my second colleague is talking about this return to kind of neoliberal fascism. We're going to divide up the world and have spheres of interest as if the multipolar world doesn't exist, BRICS doesn't exist. You know, this is all part of this idea that Trump has and others in the Pentagon have been pushing that, you know, you need to break apart China and Russia. You know, the world's number one resource country and the world's number one manufacturing company with a border that we cannot, you know, we can't interfere with. That is frightening to Washington. And it's also frightening that you start having coalitions of regional powers and super regional powers like BRICS, SCO, BRI. These are real threats. This is what keeps Washington up at night. The idea that they can no longer be a bully and walk around like they can cut the world up like a cake if they did at Yalta. This is not Yalta. We're not recovering from World War II. We're looking perhaps at World War III because of the United States' inability to recognize that times have passed.
Christian, you wanted to jump in there. Go ahead, please.
Oh, yeah, you misrepresented what I said. I said of its own making. Yeah, the U.S. embraced deindustrialization.
I think you meant
that. In the name of neoliberal economics, a lot of this tracks back to neoclassical economics and the idea and its hegemony beginning in the 1960s going forward. The idea that the only thing that mattered was prices. Where something is produced, immaterial, doesn't matter. As long as markets clear, you can have strategic resources be housed in a country that you're pushing around and mistreating. As long as the prices are fine, then everything flows. And that is, in retrospect, absolutely ridiculous. But I don't know, maybe part of the show here is that we're supposed to disagree, but I feel like
it's perfectly, gentlemen, it's perfectly.
We're actually kind of all on the same page and talking about the structural shifts in U.S. position and political economy that underwrite this whole new reality.
Christian, we can agree with you.
A kind of fascism within spheres of influence.
Listen, we can agree
that's
with
how you. Want to put it in.
No. I think you can. I can agree.
Crosstalk.
You're doing just fine, and that's the whole point of the program, and I think one can agree with you and Einar at the same time, just from different trajectories. So I don't see the argument as maybe as starkly as you do. But I mean, it does kind of put into relief how the United States is going to have to deal with the world that it created since the Second World War. And I think we all would agree that Washington is in a bit of a quandary. And now I'm going to interrupt myself. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on great power politics. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaVelch. Remind you, we're discussing great power politics. Okay, let's go back to Christian in New York. I still want to go, maybe it's a bit of a fool's errand because it hasn't been published yet, but what I've gleaned from what's in this new national defense strategy, it seems to be not maybe a rejection, but certainly a departure of the liberal order that the United States and the Western world created after the Second World War to the present. Is it going to be that easy? You have one document here. You have a huge bureaucracy. We have a history when Trump was president the first time. The State Department, the Defense Department, and other departments just simply ignored him. So, I mean, is it that easy to depart from a legacy that is so deeply entrenched in global institutions?
Well, you know, it's never been done, so we'll see. I mean, I imagine it will be difficult, but in some ways, it won't be necessarily as political as we might imagine because, again, there are these structural constraints. We have half the world's aircraft carriers, but half of our aircraft carriers are unfit for battle, right? I mean, look at what happened with the war against the Houthis.
Good point.
You know, the U.S. sort of just unilaterally declared victory and left, and then the Houthis sank two ships or sank one, disabled another, not a peep from the U.S. So there's, you know, there is an element of structural necessity to this stepping back. And that, I think, makes it easy because it makes it necessary. I think the most difficult element in all this, honestly, will be the intelligence services, the Central Intelligence Agency in particular. That's what was so significant about going after USAID, right? So the CIA, one of the most effective systems of global hegemony that the U.S. has developed over the last two generations is the Central Intelligence Agency, its color revolutions, its bloody hot wars in the global south. So coming to terms with the CIA, I think, is going to be the most difficult thing that the Trump administration faces.
Well, and another great, let me go to David right now, another great challenge, and I'm being polite here, is all of the treaty obligations that the United States has all over the world, okay? You know, we have NATO, we have this ARCUS, we have these other organizations where the United States is deeply militarily involved, particularly like in Africa. How is this new approach coming from the Trump administration going to change that or, I'm kind of answering my own question, those kind of issues will be farmed out to regional powers. What's your take on that?
Well, I think that Trump's national defense strategy is really a brilliant document. He has a lot of great, brilliant ideas. His execution has been very poor. He often executes in the exact opposite way that his own strategy dictates. But as far as the treaty obligations, there's a lot of misunderstandings about NATO Article 5, for example.
True.
Article 5 of the Atlantic Alliance really doesn't require us to go to war if one of our allies, NATO allies, are attacked. It doesn't even require us to send troops. We could respond with a harshly worded letter against a Russian aggression against the Baltics or Poland, and that would suffice in Article 5. So, a lot of these alliance agreements are really, I think, ultimately would be at the whim of the President of the United States how to react to that to attacks on our allies. So I don't think they're ironclad, as the Biden administration used to state. And as far as spheres of influence, that's a concept I think that would be supported by China as well. If we accorded them, recognized a sphere of influence, a Chinese sphere of influence over Taiwan, for example, Mongolia, Southeast Asia, the South China Sea. Really, that's all they've been asking for, is just that they would have kind of the exclusive military influence over those areas. And if we were to vacate all U.S. Navy ships out of the second island chain, I think we could come to a grand bargain with China as well. So that's what I've been advocating for decades, is that we come to a peaceful accommodation with both Russia and China, establish our own spheres of influence, and then we avert any military confrontation and focus on economic great power competition instead.
Well, then why does everybody give Yalta a bad word? I actually think Yalta was a success. It was the end of the Second World War, and things were divvied up. I mean, you can talk about the morality of it, but people confuse morality with geopolitics all of the time, particularly neocons. Einar, okay, slicing up the world in different spheres of influence, it sounds really simple, but it's not. Many countries in the Western Hemisphere have trade agreements with China. China is welcomed with open arms. China invests. It doesn't just make military bases. It builds schools and bridges and ports and things like that. With this new Monroe-esque approach, the Americans aren't going to like that very much, will they?
I don't even know why we're talking about this. It's a pipe dream. I mean, China's going in the opposite direction. It's trying to encourage this kind of idea that civilizations work together. They don't see the world as zero sum. You know, obviously, anybody who believes that you're splitting up the world and that this is okay sees it as a zero sum game. I win, you lose. I mean, the fact is, Yalta ended World War II and began the Cold War. And that's where we are today, all right? So this idea that somehow this was all a beautiful thing, as Donald Trump would like to put it, is nonsense, all right? The fact is that China isn't going to suddenly change tacks and go away from its security initiative, development initiative. It started civilization initiative, and then, of course, the newly created idea, or I should say, a logical next step is a global governance initiative. Those are exact opposite of exactly what's being preached here. And it's just not going to work. The global South was, even after World War II, subject to the vagaries of colonialism. All that you happened in World War II afterwards was that there was a substitution of financial colonialism by the United States over physical colonialization, which had happened under Europe. So all of this idea that somehow, things have changed in untoward ways and things like that, and all we need to do is divvy the world up like a cake, I mean, that's fascistic. I mean, I don't know how else you can put it. You're saying that you three countries rule the world. They can do what they want. Oh, a stern letter will do it. Well, I'll tell you, that's not the way that the Europeans see Article 5, and you can rewrite it however you want, just as they did when Baker made this statement that, no, not one inch would NATO encroach into the former Soviet Union. I mean, international politics is about trust. The U.S. has run out of it, right? China, other countries are trying to rebuild it. China and Russia know that they're stronger together than they are apart. That's why you heard them talking about this new gas line that would almost double the amount of gas going on.
The power of Siberia. I just love the name. That's power of Siberia number two, gentlemen here. Christian, let me, you know, thinking about the past here, I know it's not legally official right now, but I mean, in common parlance, it's the Department of War again. How do you feel about that? It's probably an apt description because that's what they do.
Yeah, I mean, I see that as part of this theater for the domestic audience. I remember learning that the Defense Department had once been called the Department of War from radicals, where they say, see, this is like, you know, that once upon a time, they used to have the honesty to admit that that's what it's all about. Now we have euphemism. So, I mean, this is one of Trump's political tricks and tools that he uses on the home front, which is to say the truth, you know, the grim truth, and the audience loves it. And he does that increasingly for lack of real progress on the other fronts, right? So he has erected all these trade barriers. China was the center of that, right? It's going to, like, make China pay. Well, there are no tariffs on China as of yet, and there probably won't be particularly tough ones because China structurally has the U.S. by the throat economically, and there's really not that much the U.S. can do. There's no way we can suddenly replace the rare earth elements monopoly that China has, right? That's a structural fact the U.S. has to deal with. So there's a lot of bluster and BS around this, and so that's how I view the War Department. And in a way, it's almost like a tell. I mean, it's this empire that made war constantly from the end of World War II in the global South as part of the hot sphere of the Cold War. And now it is less and less capable of doing that for reasons of its own unwitting making. As I said earlier, right, this neoliberal fantasy that only prices matter, the actual production in actual places can be ignored. And now, lo and behold, we have massive deindustrialization, which has led to rising inequality internally, social crisis internally, and a lack of economic power globally. And so a lot of the most bellicose stuff that Trump does, like renaming the Defense Department the War Department, bombing some boat that may or may not have had fentanyl into it, this is cover. This is like a squid spraying ink to hide itself. So that's how I see it. I don't really get into the morality of it because it strikes me as fundamentally theatrical.
I don't either. Geopolitics and morality are not bedfellows. And when you marry them together, you get into even more trouble. We're rapidly running out of time.
There's a risk that this kind of theater can escalate, and like there could be something ridiculous like attacking Venezuela.
I want to give David the last word because that's exactly right. How is this America First attacking Venezuela? 1 minute, my friend. David.
Well, I think Venezuela certainly, you know, that is it's a communist country. It doesn't pose a major threat to the U.S., but it certainly poses some threat. You know, there's been Russian bombers that have visited, Chinese military advisors. So I'm much more comfortable with the U.S. invading Venezuela than interfering in Taiwan and risking World War III with China.
I've spent a bunch of time in Venezuela and in Iraq. Invading and occupying Venezuela would be a serious mess.
When those wars could go nuclear, I've always wanted the U.S. to revert to being a hemispheric superpower, not a global superpower that has large military forces stationed in the Eurasian supercontinent.
Well, gentlemen, as usual, anything associated with the Trump administration is very controversial. We've just demonstrated it on this program. That's all the time we have, gentlemen. I want to thank my guests in Salt Lake City, New York, and in Beijing. And, of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk rules.